It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 95 for Friday the 28th of September 2012. On the show today, we discuss the alleged Facebook security breach that's getting privacy activists hot under the collar, the strange eating habits of the vampire squid, and a potential new revenue stream for Twitter. We'll also be talking about the attempt by an ailing MySpace to claw back users, how the 1960s cartoon The Jetsons predicted the devices of the future, and hearing from Brian Eno about his latest generative music app. All that and more coming up. Hello, I'm Olivia Solon, and I'm the associate editor of Wired.co.uk. And joining me is reporter Leah Clark.
Hello, hello.
And junior staff writer Ian Steadman.
Hello.
Hello. How are we today?
Good.
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. So this is the second week that Nate's been away, so I get to have my hands at the reins of the podcast. And it feels good. It feels good. But Nate, I'm a little bit worried he's not going to come back. He seems to be having a lovely time.
Yeah. Yes. A lot of photos of him sprawled on the floor with cats in cat cafes, looking in his element.
Looking slightly delirious and a little bit kind of... addicted to it, perhaps.
Exactly. But Nate, if you're listening, we do still want you back.
Please give us a call.
We'll get an office cat.
We'll get an office cat and cafe equipment. And that'll hopefully draw him back. I've also just come back from holiday. I'm a husk of my former self. I came back from Ibiza. But you guys have been manning the ship of the website very, very effectively, right?
Yeah, we've been steering it. Left, right. It's been good.
And Ian, you met with Brian Eno this week.
I did, yes.
Very exciting.
Oh, it was great.
We'll be hearing all about that later. But in one word, if you could sum it up, how would you sum it up?
Fascinating.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's not a great word. Eno.
Ambient.
Ambient is so much better.
Mackerel.
Mackerel.
I don't know. Just thinking of random word association now.
You got sexy and mackerel.
Okay, we'll be listening to the sexy, fishy, dulcet tones of Brian Eno later. But let's just crack on with this week's news. First of all, people have been getting very stressy pants about Facebook privacy settings again. It always seems to get people very hot under the collar. But this seems to be a bit of a non-story, I think. Facebook's obviously very often in the news about different privacy scares, but this time people suddenly started freaking out about the fact that their personal and private messages that they'd been sending between friends, but before 2009 I think, were suddenly being published on their timeline, and everyone got up in arms and they were outraged that suddenly all these private messages were now out in the public. However, the story seems to be not really a story at all. It's just that people have forgotten that in 2009 they were oversharing a bit too much. Yeah.
It's if you look at posts from that time, it's interesting how I think because Facebook was still quite a new thing, the format of how people wrote posts was different. They were a bit more formal, a bit more like emails almost.
Yes, and I guess because you weren't able to comment underneath someone's comment on your wall, you did a series of different like single, what looked like single
back
messages.
Back and forth, people were using it like an open email
system. I have to say though, when I got back from holiday and I went to look over my messages, there were a few that I was a bit like, oh, maybe that was a private message, because one of them was about some guy I fancied who I know was going to be on Facebook.
But maybe you weren't friends with him and you assumed.
Well, that's a good point. And
also, a lot of people just overshare at the moment on walls anyway. They treat them as if they're messages, but they're not.
But so I guess
how the hell were we oversharing before then? We must have been really bad if people have really looked back and thought, horrendous stuff I see now on friends' walls.
Yeah, but Facebook has come out and they've absolutely denied this. They said there's no way that that's happening. The two systems are actually entirely separate, the way the databases are stored. There are still people, you know, claiming that their private messages are being published, but so far we haven't seen any screen grabs.
Yeah, no screen grabs.
And no kind of tangible evidence. Every single message that people have claimed to have been private, Facebook's gone back, looked through their systems and discovered that they weren't. I think the weird thing is that it used to be once if things fell off the bottom of the timeline, you kind of didn't really see them ever again. And now that they've just come back and you're seeing your ridiculousness from 5 years ago.
Who are these people also going back to, you know, 2010 to look at their old posts.
I mean, that might be what it is. So few people go far that bad.
Yeah, that's why we've never realised now that they're shocked.
But if you're worried about it, it's very, very easy to change the settings. I'd take a look over your wall. If there's anything that you're embarrassed about, you can very easily either delete them or just hide them, kind of using fairly simple settings. I deleted whole years at a time just by...
Oh, did you?
Yeah, they kind of aggregated all my 2008, 2009 messages.
That's why I like Timeline, because I think it's actually one of the most pro-privacy moves Facebook's made in a long time.
Well, I think that's up to the debate. Yeah.
I mean, it's not a big thing because it's by relative standards.
But at least you know where it is rather than just being somewhere in the database of Facebook where it was before. But yes, these old posts have sort of been rising from the dead like vampires. Also a little bit like vampires are the vampire squid. Now, Liat, this week a kind of mystery about the vampire squid has been solved, hasn't it?
Yeah, these poor guys have been getting a bad rap for quite a long time. I mean, they've got a pretty horrendous name, which in Latin, the Latin actually translates to vampire squid from hell.
Oh. So that's awkward to try and meet people when you've got a name like that, isn't it?
Well, hence, they kind of hunker down, hang out about 900 metres below the water's surface, don't have many friends, keep clear of predators. And until now, no one really knew what they fed on. There were inconclusive results from dissecting the deceased vampire squids. This group has taken it upon themselves to find out exactly what they're eating and how. And it turns out they're probably the only squid on the planet that doesn't feed on live creatures. They, in fact, eat feces and corpses.
Well, as in human cadavers or just fish?
No, they like to call it marine snow, which is basically debris that has fallen to the bottom of the seabed, which is bits and pieces of dead fish and other tasty stuff.
You wouldn't want to stick your tongue out there to catch it, would you?
Well, unless
you were a vampire squid.
Unless you're a vampire squid, apparently.
Well, funnily enough, instead they use this kind of tentacle, very thin filament. They have a couple of filaments on their bodies that can extend to 8 times their body length. And these tentacles leave these weird umbrella-like mouths. If you look at photos of them online, they look like a kind of black umbrella on its side.
Okay.
With 8 arms and these filaments hanging out.
And these filaments catch the bits of snow. Yeah, actually bits of dead corpse.
Exactly. They grab them, they drag them in, they cover them in mucus secreted from their arms on suckers. Glue them together into balls, and then they use the spines that are located all down their arms to stick them in their mouths and eat them. And apparently they think this is the only marine organism that eats in this way. It's the only time they've ever witnessed it happen. And they concluded also they watched them in the labs, they watched them using remotely operated vehicles underwater and, you know, slice them up, and found there's no conclusive evidence at all that they eat live creatures.
So they're not sucking any blood of anyone?
No, just fecal matter and dead fish.
No biggie. Okay, so the thing that is new is just that they've been completely misunderstood. And now we know how they eat, and it's just as extraordinary as if they did suck on other creatures' blood.
It is, but I think they should change their name, you know.
Slightly less noble, isn't it, if you don't eat vampires?
Is it noble to...
Well, vampires kind of have this kind of glam around them, but they sound more like hyenas of the ocean.
Oh, well, there we go. Maybe that's a potential new name for them.
Yeah.
And the discovery was made by the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, right?
Yes.
Excellent.
Hendrick and Bruce.
You've been there?
The Monterey Bay Aquarium. It's a huge aquarium. It's absolutely amazing. I highly recommend if you're in Northern California going there.
What was your fave creature?
They had a stingray petting zoo thing, you know. things where they're just like
a
little shallow tank.
I tried to get my 3-year-old niece to do that, and she just like, looked at me like, yes, I was a vampire squid. Like, she was very upset.
Excellent. So while the squid are foraging for food, there are some other social networks foraging for new business, particularly an old favourite of mine, MySpace.
It's back.
It's back. It's been trying to come back for quite a while. Ian, what's going on? Are you attracted to MySpace again?
I tell you, I actually am. I didn't expect to be, but I mean, all they have released is a video of what it's going to look like, but they've launched this redesign. Going back, it was bought by this company called Specific Media in 2010 for about $35 million, which is about £21.5 million. Specific Media is a media firm, but Justin Timberlake was one of the investors as well, which kind of got it in the news.
Yeah.
Also, the fact it was a fraction of the $530 million that Rupert Murdoch and News Corporation spent on it.
Bit embarrassing.
Yeah, just 5 years earlier. And everything everything kind of went wrong for it. But they've done this redesign that looks really nice. It borrows heavily from Pinterest, I think.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, if you think of a sideways scrolling Pinterest with all your Facebook posts, and if I say Facebook posts, you see, that's the kind of,
your posts
on MySpace this time, arranged kind of like tiles, as they would in Pinterest, and side scrolling. But what's most interesting about it is that music is kind of integrated into the site so heavily.
Okay.
And that is really, I guess, what the attraction of MySpace was for the investors, because it has a huge collection of music. Apparently 42 million songs-ish on the site, which is, I mean, that's like, Spotify has about 16 million.
Okay, it's because so the artists are still, even though they might have moved on to other platforms, they've still got a presence on MySpace, the musicians who were there at the big start.
I don't know exactly how many people still use MySpace. I mean, SoundCloud, I think, really has picked up the slack over the past couple of years, where MySpace used to have that hole where even though people left MySpace and didn't use their profiles, they still hosted their band's music on there.
Yeah.
But you've still got a huge amount of music on there, music videos and stuff like that. And the new MySpace design really integrates it all with that and becomes, I think the idea will be, hopefully, if people come to listen to music, they'll sign up and they'll share other content.
Okay.
It seems like a decent way into it.
And so I guess MySpace really went wrong. It got really messy. It allowed too much customization.
Yeah.
So the design just looked like a complete mess. It was very scrappy and tatty. And brands who would otherwise have advertised there no longer wanted to advertise there because it was just a nasty environment to have your brand associated with.
Yeah.
But now you think that actually it's a nice environment and potentially there could be opportunities for companies.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at how Facebook was compared to MySpace, Facebook came along with this clean, nice site. Everyone had the same kind of thing. It just felt more professional.
Yeah.
MySpace looks a step beyond that now as well. Timeline, by comparison, already looks really outdated.
Yeah.
So it will be interesting.
It's very plain.
It will be interesting to see how that goes. Do we have any idea of when it's going to launch? We just have this video.
We just have this video. It's soon. Soon.
Soon. Okay.
Yes.
So watch out for that coming out soon. another social networking site that's looking for more revenue streams and also in the music space is Twitter. Now, Twitter has had a problem with working out what its actual business model is. It's always been, you know, going for the users and then trying to work out how it's going to monetize those users later. And we've seen sponsored links being the main kind of source of revenue so far, and doing deals with data companies as well to allow them access to all of their data. However, it's now looks like it might be going down the affiliate marketing route with music and potentially other goods. So affiliate marketing is when you as a one website hosts either links or a widget to someone else's website that allows your visitors to buy something from that other person's website. And then when they do that, your website gets a little bit of a cut. So in order for the website that you're sending your visitors to know that you've come from your site, you have to have a special URL. Now, Evolver FM has noticed that Twitter started using its own affiliate URLs to go to places like iTunes. So, for example, if you were to post about a new song that you wanted to buy, currently iTunes allows you, I think, to get a little cut of the money by sharing that. But Twitter is now replacing any links that you've put in to that music with its own link, which means that Twitter therefore take the cut. I think it's 5 cents at the moment.
Well, there are a lot of links posted on Twitter every day, so that's going to be a lot of money.
So, the idea is that Twitter is saying that given that we are allowing you to share whatever you want on our network, we should be the people to get the cut from any affiliate relationship, as opposed to, say, if Wired UK had, you know, were using our account to send out tweets to music or any other goods. In that instance, we might have otherwise got the 0.5 cents per song that was then bought as a result of sharing that link. Now, this is quite a cheeky move potentially, but it's, I think it's a really interesting one for Twitter. It's something that Pinterest actually already does. It replaces any link that you put to Amazon, I think, any book, any music, and it replaces it with its own affiliate link so that it always makes the revenue from that.
Does this apply to other URL shortening services like Bitly? So if you already shortened the link using something like Bitly or TinyURL.
Yeah, we're not 100% clear, but it appears at the moment that it's only if you use the web app or the native like Twitter app as opposed to third-party apps, and that you're using its URL shortener. So at the moment, it doesn't seem that it has the ability to change Bitly links, but that's not to say that it won't force people to use its own shortener. And also it might then make third-party apps also do the same thing.
Would explain the cracking down on the API.
For me, this is a perfect solution for Twitter. You know, we all get this service for free, and why not take a little skim of any revenues generated from people sharing on its social media service? We get loads of benefits, for example, traffic back to Wired UK through Twitter. So perhaps this is the thing that Twitter can actually make money from.
Yeah, it's a fairly modest proposal for in exchange for what they deliver.
But it does go down to the who owns the followers debate. Like, is it Twitter who owns our, for example, Wired UK's followers, or my, you know, at Olivia underscore Solon followers? Is it Twitter who owns those, or is it me? And I think it's fine for me and perhaps for Wired, but if you're a music magazine who otherwise has affiliate relationships on your website and you see Twitter as an extension of your media platform, I think you might be a bit more annoyed. But anyway, at the moment, we're only seeing these links being changed for iTunes in Europe and in the US. But there's no reason why it couldn't be for Amazon or for any books or apps, etc., etc. But anyway, moving on, while Twitter may also be taking a little bit of money from Amazon, also taking money from Amazon could be Barnes & Noble with the launch of Nook over here in Europe. Liat?
Yes, Barnes & Noble, if you don't know them, they're a massive US bookstore chain, like Foils, but on an epic scale. They have over 1,000 stores in the US compared with Waterstones, which has just a couple hundred.
There was a time when Waterstones had a lot more than that.
But yeah, but Barnes & Noble, it does have a big presence in the US and a great reputation.
Yeah. Okay, so they've launched two new tablets. So these are going to kind of compete against other e-readers, things like the Kindle, I guess.
They are actually launching in the UK at the same time as the US Kindle Fire. We've had to wait a year for it to come out, whereas now they're launching simultaneously. We should see it in stores by mid-November. The main difference with the Nook HD and the Nook HD Plus is they have great resolution and they're positioned at a great price point. For instance, the HD, which is a 7-inch, is 243 pixels per inch, which they claim is the highest resolution of any 7-inch tablet. And the Nook HD Plus has 256 pixels per inch. Now, if you compare that with the iPad's Retina display, which is 264 pixels per inch, it looks pretty impressive, and it just outdoes Kindle Fire HD by 2 pixels per inch, I believe.
That's just a tip for tat, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, at the price it's at, it's about, I think it's £229 they're positioning at.
For the 9-inch Nook, it's
for the 9-inch HD Plus. And considering the resolution is pretty near the iPad, and the iPad starts at £400, that's the market they're targeting. Obviously, it's not going to have the same usability, but it has 10 hours of battery life for reading. It's got user profiles like on a computer. It's kind of more aimed at families, so you have parent controls and things like that.
So how much memory has it got?
8 gigabytes. They've got an 8 gigabyte model and 16 gigabytes, but there's also a micro SD slot of up to 64 gigabytes.
So, I mean, this does really seem to be a kind of direct attack on the Kindle as opposed to the iPad. I mean, it's kind of lower spec than something like the iPad. But, you know, I guess one of the issues is it doesn't have the same, Barnes & Noble doesn't have the same gravitas over here as it does over in the States. So where is it going to be stocked?
Yeah, a lot of people haven't heard of Barnes & Noble. So they've partnered up with very well-known brands like Argos, Blackwell's, Sainsbury's and Foyles. And you can purchase the tablets online and in store.
So it seems a bit of a shame that we haven't got our own device. You know, I think there was talk at one point that there was going to be from our bookstores, but they're obviously ailing too much to be able to
I just don't think they can compete at all on the same scale. I mean, Barnes & Noble is massive in the States and they've been going since 1870s, I think it is. They have a really strong presence and identity there, whereas Waterstones has been around since the 80s and has flailed in the last decade.
Yeah. Also, I think Waterstones, a couple of years ago, it only stocked the Sony e-readers, which did not do well.
No, they did not. So when are we going to be able to get our hands on the Nook HD and the Nook HD Plus?
Mid-November, and that's a month after their e-readers, the Nook Simple and Nook Simple Touch, are released.
And that's more comparable to the regular Kindle,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. Well, look forward to seeing how that little battle pans out. We're about to have an ad break, but when we come back, we'll find out how enslaved ants get their own back.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Welcome back. So, Liat, enslaved ants, they're fighting back.
Yes, finally, these ants that have been subjected to brood parasitism.
Now, what's this?
This is when their colony is attacked and expelled, or the brood stolen, and these enslaved ants actually start caring for the stolen brood and the brood of their captors.
So hang on, the adult ants invade a nest that's existing, they dispel all of the other adults and steal their babies, and then they add their babies to the mix.
Yeah, and then they get the worker
ants. A few worker ants to look after the new stolen hatchlings.
Yeah, basically keep the worker ants, they can look after the kids, we can go attack their relatives on the other side.
Okay.
Now, what we found out is that when the captors' larvae start to pupate, something is triggered in the slaves. There are chemical cues that are released when they begin to pupate, and that is when the ants recognize, wait a minute, these aren't our kids, what are we doing?
Okay. And then what happens?
Does one of them stand up and shout, I am Spartacus? And
another, I am they Spartacus. Do that. No, they're too busy tearing apart the pupae and killing them. They either neglect them, which is pretty bad in itself, or they just maul them to death and they attack them in groups, or they attack them by themselves and just kill them all off. It seems that this is a new evolutionary tactic. Basically, these worker ants, they can't reproduce, so it was presumed they just carried on doing what they were doing because they had no reason to evolve any other defences, seen as they couldn't reproduce. But what we found out is that it's a kind of covert way of sabotaging their captors and helping out their cousins over in colony number two down the road.
Okay.
So they weaken the host colony and thus someone else has a fighting chance against them.
Okay, so what about the oppressors? How do they fight back against these kind of rebelling ants?
Well, it varies from colony to colony, but the researchers found out, for instance, that the New York host colony is much more aggressive, which means that they still go out and raid other nests and that their numbers are strengthened. So about 49% of their pupae survived, and that's compared to, in West Virginia, only 27% survived. So presumably they're reproducing more, they're attacking more colonies, they're bolstering their numbers more in New York.
So it's kind of tit for tat. They keep one lot evolves and the other lot evolves, and they're just trying to, you know, sustain their own races.
Yes, it's an evolutionary arms race.
Excellent. That's a lovely term. Moving on from ants, it's the obvious segue to space and the Jetsons. They were in space, weren't they? Or those on the
very
Earth?
Tall poles.
Very tall poles.
Yeah, all the buildings are on really tall poles because the ground has been laid waste by nuclear Armageddon.
Although it was made in the 1960s when we were all obsessed with the future, it was set in 2063. So we've now reached a kind of halfway point between when it was made and when it was set. So we thought it'd be a good opportunity to look back and just see what of the predictions that they make within the cartoon have come true. So we first of all had things like flat screens, which were obviously fairly easily predicted by the Jetsons, so tick on that front. And things like video phones, and who can forget Rosie the robotic maid?
Yes, she used to go crazy in basically every episode, didn't she? Something go wrong with the circuitry.
Exactly. But the humanoid butler, that's the kind of the dream to have the humanoid butler or maid who kind of does everything. It's kind of multifunctional, super agile, etc. And obviously the occasional breakdown.
We're getting there.
But there are a few other areas where they were a bit more kind of insightful. I mean, what was, Leah, what's your kind of favourite Jetsons technology?
Well, it was interesting looking at their use of nanotechnology. I believe George could, couldn't he fold up
his car?
He could
fold up stuff. Like, everything was like, it could reconfigure in different shapes and stuff.
Yeah. Which is what, you know, we hope to do one day. We're not quite there yet, but we do use nanotechnology in developing cars to make them lighter and stronger and more efficient fuel cells and things like that. Mm. And I think people have drawn up a few designs about shape-shifting cars, but
not quite yet. There. Ian, what about you? What was your
9-hour week?
9-hour week.
Three days a week, 3 hours shifts. George turns up to the sprocket factory. Whatever a sprocket is, it's like a nut or something, isn't it?
And I hope in 50 years there's something tastier than nuts.
No, it's sprockets.
Sprockets.
Is it
nuts?
No, the ones for
like
machinery.
Machinery.
I thought you said nuts.
Yeah,
nuts. Like, I didn't hear sprockets. Oops.
I think that's what a sprocket is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But yeah, they
the metal nuts.
Yeah.
I don't want them either. I don't need.
Well,
to
if they're
nuts.
Shape shifting and reconfiguring into food, then you might be okay.
Yeah, but even though they have that short week, they still complain bitterly about the fact they have so much housework to do. Even though they press a button and a little Roomba vac comes out and stuff like that, it's weird because there was a later Jetsons in the 80s that they revived it. And it's weird looking at them compared, because the 60s Jetsons is all space age stuff. I mean, that was before they landed on the moon. So there's all stuff about going to the moon, how that's really amazing. The drawings are all kind of like that American futurism kind of utopian vision. Whereas you go to the 80s Jetsons and it's all computer stuff.
Yeah.
And then computers aren't in the original one at all, but then they're everywhere in the later one, because I guess by then we realised it was going to be the big thing.
Bit dull though, isn't it, compared to the 60s?
Very
kind of
so.
lost their imagination, not really thinking big. We knew at that point everything was going to be computerised.
So Jetsons, you should have been a bit more ambitious in the 80s. Yes. That's the word of advice from the wire.co.uk podcast. So happy birthday, 50th anniversary, and we'll have to come back and discuss in 100 years. I'm not sure I'll still be here, but
we'll be cyborgs.
You'll be an avatar,
or our brains will be living in computers. Or...
Exactly, and hopefully there'll have been another kind of even less ambitious kind of version of the Jetsons in the interim. Now, finally, we're going to discuss Brian Eno, who Ian very luckily got the opportunity to meet this week.
Mm.
So, Ian, he's a bit of a hero of yours, isn't he?
I'm a big fan of his music. He's just a very influential musician. If you're not familiar with his work, he. I wouldn't say invented, but he's one of the pioneers of ambient music and the idea of kind of open freeform stuff. He did an album called Music for Airports, which is a lot more exciting than it sounds.
Yeah,
which is a good starting place.
Exactly.
But I was meeting him to talk about a new app that he's got for the iPad, which he made in collaboration with a composer called Peter Chilvers, who he's worked with before. They met when they worked on the game Spore. Actually,
okay.
They did the soundtrack to Spore. And Scape is a development of the themes within it. It's this idea of generative music, music that's never the same when you listen to it twice. It's something that Brian and Chilvers have both worked on throughout their careers.
Yeah.
Brian actually kind of popularized the term in the 90s with his album Generative Music One. And Scape is a little app that's it's really nice. It's kind of an empty canvas where you can drag and drop shapes, drawing stuff, and the stuff on the screen will interact with each other and play sounds and change depending on the time of day, their relation to each other and stuff like that.
Okay.
And I've actually got a clip of Brian discussing kind of the process of how they got to develop it.
So for Spore, we want to make a music that wasn't repetitive, and it wasn't based on sort of simple loops going around, but was based on the idea that any scene within Spore could have a kind of sonic character, but it wouldn't be exactly the same each time you visited it. And so we came up with this idea then of loading the game with a number of sounds that we called shufflers. We now call them elements. But then there were simple sets of rules for how those things combined and played out. This thing only happens when these other two things are happening. And it worked quite well in Spore, and Bloom was one of the spin-offs of that, actually. Bloom used one sound that we used in Spore. It was a big step forward in apps, the idea that you could actually make a piece of art rather than something that was a kind of interesting technical curiosity. And so this is another step to sort of say, okay, what about if we start to use a bigger family of elements?
And the thing that's really interesting about this idea is the idea that a machine can create things, because obviously creativity is something that's quite human, I think. Mm. But there's this element of randomness we don't normally associate with computerized sound, and that's what's kind of interesting. Chilvers saying that he loved this idea because electronic instruments lack a bit of eccentricity, and he likes to be able to put fuzziness back into it.
Okay.
And there's a little clip here from him describing how it differs to composing normally.
Technically, it's a finite space of sounds that you could actually make with it, but it's a pretty huge one. I mean, there's something like 90-odd different elements. And it's not just that, say, those could be combined in 90 different ways.
Yeah.
The way they're combined will affect the type of sound. That every one of those elements kind of has a quite complex program behind it. They effectively are 90 individual programs behind them. And so they are thinking, some of them will very specifically respond to thinking sort of three other things have made a sound now, I won't for a while, or everything's noisy, that's definitely the time I want some attention.
So yeah, you can think of it as an album that's never the same each time, or as they describe it, it's a chance to collaborate on a piece of music with Brian Eno and Peter Chilvers, which is pretty cool.
That's an excellent sales line.
Okay, so what was he like when you met him?
Really nice. He was kind of exactly what you'd imagine. I met him at his studio in Notting Hill, and it walking him on the keyboards, having a little play, paintings and stuff, instruments everywhere. It was just kind of exactly what you imagine, wearing a kind of a blazer and a shirt and just kind of looking like Brian, you know, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
Did you get to jam with him?
Unfortunately not, and I would only have embarrassed myself.
So what about this app? Where can we buy it? When can we buy it?
It's already out. It's on the App Store. It's $3.99. You can go there now. It's called Scape. So go have a play with it. You can share anything that you make as well. And also what's quite cool is that when you send it to someone, it doesn't just load up as a file, like a solid file. Okay. It comes up in the sort of sandbox creativity area. So you can change anyone else's composition. And as they share around, they'll evolve and change. You know, they're never the same.
And what else is he up to, old Eno?
He's just announced a new album, which he wouldn't really talk about, so I don't really know much about. He was very tight-lipped about it. All I know is that it's called Lux, and it's his first solo album since 2005.
Yeah.
And it's going to be quite long. It's kind of another ambient piece. So.
And another ambient album. And was he starry? Did you get the impression that he, you know, he was...
Very down to earth. It was raining really heavily when I left, and he offered to lend me an umbrella. You know.
What a lovely, lovely man.
Gentleman.
Well, Ian's written a fantastic story about that that you'll be able to find if you search for Brian Eno on wire.co.uk. But that is all we've got time for today. Next week, Nate will be back as normal, provided he does manage to part from the cat cafes.
We'll have to forcibly separate them.
But remember, Nate, we are still here, so just give us a call. Let us know how you're doing.
We miss you.
We miss you. Leah, how can people get in touch with us?
Well, you can follow us on Twitter, we're at Wired UK, or check us out on Facebook, or alternatively email us at podcast@wired.co.uk.
Thanks very much for listening. That's all we have time for, so see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. I don't like to admit it, but sometimes, you know, we check out Argos online.